Welcome to the second edition of Mitsubishi Electric's Let's Talk Consultant Focus podcast. I'm Rob Conway, and my guest today is Richard Wenger, Head of Engineering Solutions for Mitsubishi Electric UK. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Rob.
The aim of this podcast is to provide expert insight on the fast-changing HVAC market in the UK and the new solutions now available to help HVAC consultants and specifiers meet the needs of building owners with a specific focus on large commercial projects. So, Richard, let's start with defining what is a large building in the UK market and why is Mitsubishi Electric actually focusing on this particular area?
Yeah, that's a great question, Rob. It's a subjective term, the term large commercial building. We generally define them as above 10,000 square meters gross internal area. The reason why we focus on that particular group of buildings is, A, they can be the most challenging in terms of coming up with energy strategies, especially around retrofit. They represent a big share of the energy required across the building stock in the UK, and therefore a large share of carbon emissions. But the relatively small number of properties, less than 15% of the buildings that we have in the UK are classed as large commercial buildings.
All right. Thanks, Richard. From your research and customer feedback, what are the key challenges that owners of these buildings are facing right now?
Yeah, so the landscape is changing quite rapidly now. The idea of building new large commercial buildings is becoming more challenged because planning authorities, local authorities, want to understand why it is you're demolishing the building that came before it. Most of these large buildings will exist in inner city, and most of those sites where new large buildings are being planned, there are existing buildings on the site. If you think about public sector, for instance, the idea of knocking down an acute hospital to replace it with something shiny and new, that process before we even get to energy efficiency is much more challenging. We need to be able to prove why we can't use the existing building before we think about new construction. So therefore, retrofit becomes and will become a much bigger part of the changes to the built environment. We've seen figures over the last 6 to 12 months. New construction, applications for new construction are going down in the UK, and therefore retrofit is becoming more and more of solving this challenge.
What are the main drivers behind the significant changes you're experiencing in how these very large buildings and projects are heated, cooled, and ventilated?
Yeah, so I'd say probably the biggest driver to an owner of a building or an owner of an estate is the inherent value in that estate. You know, it's important for building owners and for developers to understand what the value of their buildings is going to be for the long future. And there's a general correlation. A recent report from JLL has shown that there is strong correlation between the value of a building and its energy efficiency, its carbon emissions. So over time, it's clear to building developers and building owners now that inefficient buildings will become less and less valuable. We talk about this concept of stranded assets, this idea that once a building falls below certain levels of energy efficiency, the value starts to really decline to the point where the money that you would need to replace the energy efficiency technologies within that building become harder and harder to do because it's harder and harder to attract funding because the inherent asset is reducing in value. This basic trend is forcing and is pushing lots and lots of change across the industry. And we're starting to see lots of investment in existing building stock. There, I see those as internal drivers. That is a business ensuring that it has long-term viability in its business model. That's very important for this because it's a costly activity. There are other drivers coming from, for instance, central government. There's been a lot of uncertainty around the role of legislation in the existing building stock. Legislation for minimum energy efficiency standards has kind of flip-flopped and U-turned for the last few years, actually. But it seems generally accepted by the community that those efficiency standards will come. And those efficiency standards will make it very difficult for building owners to lease their buildings to tenants with very low standards of efficiency. However, when it comes to new construction, when it comes to making planning applications for new buildings, the legislation is very clear. You have to build buildings with the highest standards of energy efficiency, very low carbon emissions, and you must use the lowest carbon technologies available for that building.
Thanks, Richard. I'm really getting an understanding from an existing large building that's being renovated, reused, refitted. But is it are the same drivers there for owners of new developments and new projects where significant investment is being applied for?
So the drivers for new construction are much stronger. Building regulations are very stringent at the moment, putting a lot of pressure on the energy strategy of new buildings that are planned to being built. Those energy strategies require the lowest levels of energy usage within that building, high levels of energy recovery, and therefore very, very low carbon emissions. And those energy strategies almost insist on using the best available technology in terms of renewables or low carbon technologies. It's very, very difficult to build buildings using older technologies and fossil fuels now.
Given these significant drivers of change, what are central government doing to safeguard the transition to heat pumps? And what are they doing also to remove the barriers?
Yeah, it's a good question, Rob. So we're seeing the government do now what we've seen them do a few times before in the last decade or two. If we think back to the creation of the solar PV market in the UK, we saw huge incentives from the government in the form of a feed-in tariff, which made it very attractive for new adopters of that technology to install them on their properties and reap the benefits, reap the rewards of both the feed-in tariff and the reduction in energy costs. If we look at what happened immediately after, we saw a few things. We saw kind of a flood of new products, much cheaper, much more availability. A lot of products coming from China, photovoltaic products coming from China. That made entry into that technology easier for homeowners and for building owners, business owners. But we also saw a very vast kind of expansion of the contracting base. You know, the skill sets, the knowledge, the capabilities, and the businesses to drive that industry started to invest because they saw the opportunity. And over that period of time, we saw the government reducing that feed-in tariff. As the technology became more mature, as the market became more mature, as the entry to that market became easier for homeowners, feed-in tariff reduced to what it is today, which is barely anything. The government did exactly what it wanted to achieve. It created the industry in a very short period of time, made it very attractive to enter from a supplier, from a contracting point of view, and made it very attractive from a homeowner or business owner point of view. If we cut now to heat pumps, which seems to be the predominant technology for large buildings in terms of decarbonization, we see similar levels of incentive, but in this case, comes today in the form of public sector decarbonization. We're seeing that incentive driving lots of change in the industry and creating lots of opportunity for both suppliers and for contractors to grow their expertise, their understanding, to improve their products and to improve their knowledge of those products and come up with energy efficiency solutions for both building owners and business owners.
So you think the government are getting it right this time?
Yeah, I think interestingly, the Public Sector Decarbonisation Fund, this we're talking about £2.5 to £3 billion of investment across the UK. That's doing a number of things. It's creating expertise in the industry. It's growing that skill set. It's growing that contractor base. It's growing design knowledge and capabilities. It's putting more pressure on suppliers to ensure they have the right supply chains because the demand for heat pumps amongst other low carbon technologies is growing. And the genius part of it all is at the end of that process, at the end of the Public Sector Decarbonisation Fund, the government will have authority and ownership over this huge estate of public sector buildings that are now energy efficient using the lowest carbon technologies with the best efficiencies and the lowest carbon. That's a real win-win situation. And what we're seeing already now is that those products, those technologies, those designers and those contractors are using those skills and expertise in the commercial world, in the private sector. And it's really rapidly changing the industry and growing that understanding and that ability for this country and our society to decarbonize quickly.
Richard, you've talked about central government and what they're doing here, and that sounds really, really positive. Let's dig a little bit deeper. Can you tell us a little bit more in detail about this Public Sector Decarbonisation Fund? And are you at Mitsubishi Electric seeing this as a really positive promoter of sustainable change?
Yeah, Rob, absolutely. So the Public Sector Decarbonisation Fund is a set of funding from central government worth well over £2.5 billion. It's spread over three phases, started a couple of years ago, and will continue to 2026. And what it does is it gives public sector buildings and the organisations that sit behind them the cash, the money, the funding to be able to install and replace their technologies in their building with a view of reducing their energy consumption, improving their efficiency, and of course, reducing carbon. So we're now really seeing the benefits of that. We're seeing lots of change in the industry. We're seeing lots of buildings getting new heating systems, new lighting. The most popular across all of the across all of the fund requests and across all of the funding, the most popular technology is air source heat pumps. Air source heat pumps have and continue to have the biggest impact on large buildings in terms of energy efficiency, reducing energy consumption, reducing carbon. And if we look in more detail about where that money is being spent, it's really good to see that the NHS, acute hospitals and healthcare are kind of sat at the top, getting the lion's share of funding, which for me is really positive considering the fact that, you know, the NHS has had a really tough time for the last few years, and the ability of the NHS to install through government funding the most efficient energy systems in their hospitals, reducing their running costs, improving the quality of the environment within hospitals. That's really positive for this country. We're also seeing education buildings getting a lot of funding. We're also seeing local authority buildings, community buildings. So yeah, this is a huge positive promoter of sustainable change in the UK, because it means that we're seeing that, if you like, the innovation, the growth of the industry is kind of on the backbone of the public sector buildings. And at the end of all of this, you know, as I said before, we're going to see public sector buildings being the leading buildings in terms of energy efficiency, leading the private sector, if you like.
Now, we know our audience loves the detail on the latest technological developments, especially those that have come from HVAC manufacturers. For large buildings, which of the tech solutions from Mitsubishi Electric's diverse range do you see as being really beneficial for this particular segment of the market?
Yeah, so, you know, Mitsubishi Electric, like other manufacturers, you know, we're under a lot of pressure to reduce the environmental impact of the products and the solutions that we produce. Most of all, we're seeing that in changing refrigerants. I think most of our listeners will know that refrigerants in the past have been particularly bad for the environment, and we're seeing lots of pressure, and we have lots of new ideas and lots of new products that use lower GWP refrigerants. This is really important. But actually, when we change refrigerants, when we improve the sort of embodied carbon of our products, what we're seeing is that it doesn't have a huge impact on the building itself. You know, remember that embodied carbon is kind of built in. It's only considered at the end of life, if that makes sense. What we're more concerned about is operational carbon. And the innovation that we're seeing and the innovation that is becoming more important is actually we need more heat pumps to do different things in buildings. If we look at energy strategies for buildings for the last 10, 15, 20, 30 years, what you would tend to see, the biggest users of energy were usually around heating and cooling, thermal comfort, and you would usually see a single approach in terms of technology. So you'd see one gas boiler doing lots and lots of things in a building, whether it be hot water, heating, ventilation. Whereas now, because we're looking for lower temperatures, because we're looking for maximizing efficiency, we are starting to see more heat pumps suited to a particular application. Specialist heat pumps being used for hot water, specialist heat pumps used to recover energy from, for instance, cooling, for thermal heating within a building, specialist heat pumps that can produce higher levels of energy recovery. And, you know, we're starting to see these technologies coming together within buildings with their own specific needs, their own specific applications. And that seems to be the route to getting the maximum efficiency from a piece of technology. It's not a one size fits all. It's a specialist application of the right product in the right area.
Richard, you mentioned lower temperatures for heat pumps. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, sure. So heat pump technology, will always be more efficient when it's applied to lower flow temperatures. Typically, when we look at gas boiler installations going back a number of years, flow temperatures of 70 or 80 degrees were common practice. At this point in time, with the adoption of heat pumps as the kind of primary low carbon solution for heating, lower temperatures mean more efficiency and lower carbon. However, in many buildings, we've talked a lot today about hospitals. You simply can't lower those temperatures. Hospitals and many buildings need to produce hot water, for domestic hot water for sanitary purposes. We can't reduce those temperatures. So we need specialist heat pumps that can be as efficient as possible while producing 60, 70, or even 80 degrees. And I think that's where we see a big shift in terms of the innovation of technology, where we're bringing together, for example, larger machines that can produce 50 degrees very efficiently for the majority of the needs of the building, and connecting that to a water-to-water heat pump or a water source heat pump that can upgrade that 45 or that 50 degrees that the majority of the building needs, but upgrade it to 80 degrees for the purposes of hot water or for those processes within a building that simply require those higher temperatures. And we're seeing that is, if you like, unlocking the opportunities for these very large buildings.
Richard, most of our listeners will understand, but can you explain how heat pumps can now provide the large volume of high temperature water required for large commercial buildings?
Yeah, so again, you know, typically with hotels, for instance, you mentioned hotels. For, as a building designer, as the owner operator of that hotel, you need to be able to cater for, you know, all of your guests wanting a shower at roughly the same time. With heat pump technology, most recently, we've been talking a lot about CO2 heat pumps. CO2 heat pumps have been in the industry for a couple of years now. Very popular in Japan. They have been for 10, 15 years. CO2 heat pumps use CO2 as a refrigerant. When you use CO2 as a refrigerant, you get very, very high temperatures. You need to operate very high delta Ts. That means that the flow temperature coming from the heat pump can be 80 or even 90 degrees, but the return temperature coming back to the heat pump has to be below 50 degrees. And the only real application where you can get the most out of CO2 heat pumps is hot water generation. That's where we've got cold water coming in from the mains cold, and we're trying to heat water up very quickly, very efficiently, and CO2 heat pumps are a great application for that. So you talked about hotels. This is typically where we'd see a large store of hot water, typically a bit larger than, quite a bit larger than you would expect with a kind of a gas approach, a fossil fuel approach. So we're looking to store large volumes of hot water with a reasonably small CO2 heat pump that can work throughout the day, getting ready for those peak loads. And that is the most efficient approach for creating very large volumes of hot water.
You've talked a lot about high temperature hot water, but what about buildings that need high temperature hot water throughout the year on a large scale?
So we've talked a lot about hospitals today, Rob. Hospitals are a great example of large buildings that need very high temperature water across their estate. Typically, we're dealing with the infirmed. So we have to ensure that we're storing and delivering hot water that is very safe, that's been stored at a very high temperature to it, completely minimize the risk of any bacteria or any Legionella, for instance. And of course, hospitals are very warm buildings. You know, we need to ensure that we have very high levels of thermal comfort and of sterilization and things like that are going on in hospitals. So a good example is a hospital we did last year in North Tyneside. So this is a hospital where we were replacing a 50-year-old steam heating system. And we replaced it with a heat pump system that could do 80-degree flow temperature around the entire hospital. We did that using two different types of heat pump. The first was, or the first stage, if you like, was the multifunction, what we call a four-pipe heat pump. That's a heat pump that can produce both cooling and heating at the same time. And we have very high levels of heat recovery. We're reducing the requirement for energy, reducing electrical consumption because we've got this heat recovery. But one of the challenges with that technology is we can't produce very high temperature water. 45, 50 degrees, depending on the application, is really the maximum. So what we did is we supplied a second stage heat pump. So this is a very large 1.7 megawatt heat pump that can take water at 45 degrees from the heat recovery machine, and it can produce water at 80 degrees to deliver an 80-60 flow and return temperature around that hospital, giving the hospital everything it needs, but while using heat pump technology, which brings all the benefits of heat recovery, low energy, low carbon, and of course, most importantly, we're not burning any fossil fuels anymore on that site.
I assume as being obviously a key contributor to the community health, but also a huge sort of budget required to actually run a hospital of that size. Have you got any sort of feedback on sort of the efficiencies that they've managed to gain since they've put this new technology in?
Yeah, so I saw an article actually, because I've been following the project and the NHS Trust, and there's some great feedback from the head of estates for that NHS Trust. You know, enjoying the fact that there are lower running costs. They got the majority. I think they got all of their funding from public sector decarbonisation, which is something that we've talked about today. The upfront costs were covered by central government, and of course that means they've got a very energy efficient hospital, which reduces their running costs, and ultimately that leads to, you know, improvement in being able to spend more money on patients, which is the most important thing.
So I assume there is a case study online that our listeners can refer that to.
So we're actually working on a case study now, and we'll have that online very soon.
Yeah, no, Richard, we've discussed hospitals and healthcare in some depth now, but let's move on and let's look at some other big, large buildings within the UK sector, building stock sector. So let's dive into education, which covers universities, colleges, academies and schools. Obviously, over the COVID period, there was a huge focus on indoor air quality. And that debate has continued, where there's been several newsworthy sort of features that have come out. Indoor air quality, I assume, is a key consideration where education is concerned.
Yeah, definitely. The education sector represents a number of challenges in terms of heating, ventilation, and air conditioning. First of all, you know, typically in the education sector, we see large numbers of people packed into relatively small rooms. That puts pressure on ventilation and air quality. And I think even before COVID, we saw more strict rules and more focus on the quality of air, especially for education, where we're talking about younger children. There's a number of challenges across the education sector. Firstly, the infrastructure that we have in the UK spans, you know, decades. So we've got new construction, we've got new buildings, we've got new purpose-built education centres. You know, we can use our technology quite easily, it's quite easy to reduce energy efficiency. We can use lots of different technologies. But when we look at some of the older buildings, when we look at some of the universities, for instance, we're talking about buildings that are hundreds of years old. And it's important to understand that when we increase ventilation rates to improve air quality in the winter, we're increasing the heating demand as well. When you bring more cold, fresh air into a space to ensure we've got good levels of oxygen, low levels of CO2, we are creating more demand to heat that air up. We're creating more heating demand. So, you know, education is actually a really, really challenging area to operate within. But there's one big advantage with education, and that is education buildings are unoccupied for long periods of the year, typically in the summer. And that means that we have the opportunity, the time to go in and do what we call a deep retrofit, where we can go in and do quite significant works to change the energy strategy within those buildings. One of the other challenges as well is noise. So of course, you know, education buildings, we're talking typically will be within the community. They'll be next to homes, they'll be next to where we live, where we work. And, you know, noise becomes an important part of the solution as well, making sure that we've got low noise equipment where we're moving the heat source out of the plant room and outside, typically for a heat pump. We need to make sure that we're keeping within those guidelines.
And do you have any sort of recent examples that you mentioned? Obviously, the huge hospital in Tyneside. What about any universities or colleges that where you've applied some of this technology?
Yeah, so I think one piece of technology that seems to be really popular in schools is the modular technology. So if you take a large school or if you take an academy, the idea of replacing the entire energy solution in one summer can be quite challenging. So the modular approach, that is, you know, one building at a time, one wing at a time, means we have the advantage with a couple of different technologies. So, you know, hot water for the gym can be done with one piece of kit, one piece of plant. We talked about CO2 earlier. And then we see this kind of phased approach using modular equipment, which is inherently lower noise, higher efficiency. So we can go in and do a wing, or we can do a building one summer, then for the at the end of the next term, go and do the next. So this kind of decentralized approach. It's very common in universities to see these big energy centers. You know, take Birmingham University, for example. Their heating system is a huge steam generation system, where they have a big single area where they have all the plant, and then heat is distributed around the build, around the site. And it's a huge site. That approach becomes less and less favorable when you talk about heat pumps, because ideally you want to be distributing heat in a shorter run as possible, because you want to try and keep those temperatures down. So this kind of modular approach, building by building approach, seems to be more favorable in education.
Thanks, Richard. Let's also carry on that sort of looking at the different sectors, and let's focus now on the commercial sector. It's a pretty broad sector, Richard. As you know, it covers out-of-town retail sites, large hotels we've talked about, and also big offices. You know, Mitsubishi Electric must have loads of experience understanding in this sector. I was wondering if you could give us a few examples.
Yeah, of course. So, you know, as you know, Rob, Mitsubishi Electric has been, for the most part, an air conditioning business in the UK. And when we talk about air conditioning, the number one sector for us for the last 10 or 15 years has been offices. Offices are really where we have cut our teeth. It's where we've built the most expertise in terms of applications. And it's where we first started our journey with air source heat pumps for commercial heating. So yeah, absolutely. We've developed a huge amount of experience and expertise in commercial office buildings predominantly. And that's where we see the most popular technology in offices at the moment. And it makes up nearly a third of all of our heat pumps, made to order heat pumps that we sell in the UK, is four pipe, what we call four pipe multifunction. These are air source heat pumps that can produce heating and cooling at the same time. We use them across the board, but they are by far the most favorable technology in offices. And there's a good reason why. Most offices, if you look across the skyline of London, for example, where we have this huge concentration of office buildings, most of those buildings will have a chiller on the roof. You know, that goes back to the old solution of providing heating and cooling to a building, a boiler in the basement, a chiller on the roof, and that allowed the building owner the ability to provide both heating and cooling into the space simultaneously, what we call four pipe fan coils. So any room, any building, any meeting room could have heating or cooling at any time. When that chiller comes to end of life, and when the opportunity arises to improve the energy efficiency in that office building, it's very easy for offices to remove the chiller that's on the roof and replace it with a heat pump chiller that can do both heating and cooling. This approach to retrofitting and either removing the gas boiler entirely, or at least significantly reducing how much you need to run that gas boiler in that building, that has become the go-to solution for large commercial offices. We talked about hot water. Again, commercial offices tend to need less hot water typically than buildings like hotels or hospitals that we've talked a lot about. So that small amount of hot water that's required in the office is done by a smaller water-to-water booster. So again, we've got this air source unit producing both chilled and hot water. And then for the domestic hot water requirements for sanitary, just a small booster that can get you 60, 70, 80 degrees for your small hot water needs in an office.
Richard, thank you. We now know an awful lot more about each of the different sectors and the specific kit that can be applied to it. So thank you for that. A consultant can definitely work with you and Mitsubishi Electric and getting the actual specification, the bespokeness of their kit solution to exactly the needs of that building. But where is it made?
Yeah, so we make this these large-scale heat pumps in our factories in Northern Italy. Northern Italy is known for producing this type of equipment, and we have a handful of manufacturing sites spread across Northern Italy. And, you know, we actually invite both consultants, end users, to come and see what it is that we're doing there. Comes in two forms. So factory witness tests are quite common at this level when we're talking about, you know, megawatts of heat. We want to be able to prove and show you exactly what this equipment can do. You know, we have a testing facility that allows us to simulate very extreme weather conditions, very, very low temperatures. And we can demonstrate exactly how the heat pumps will operate and perform in those challenging environments. And we also do, throughout the year, regular trips to our factory so that you can see some of the innovations that we've made, some of the improvements that we've made, as we've learned more about heat pump technology, and get to show exactly what goes into making these heat pumps, to give that confidence to allow consultants ultimately to know more and be experts in this equipment, which is vital for good quality designs and getting the best out of new energy strategies for new and existing buildings.
Once they know more, what level of customization does Mitsubishi Electric offer?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, you know, we operate standard ranges. So, you know, we have predefined ranges of heat pumps, you know, they would loosely define the capacity, the size, noise, footprint, things like that. But when it comes to what it is that could be changed, you know, the strategies around how the heat pump will operate, the controllers, we can make amendments to fans. We can operate with higher static pressures, for instance, if a particular building needed noise attenuation and needed to reduce the noise levels in the external compound. We can increase the static pressure to overcome noise attenuation is a good example. That's kind of standard day-to-day. Most of our products would have this level of customization. But in some more extreme circumstances, so I gave you the example of the hospital in North Tyneside. That was a bespoke offering for that hospital so that we could offer 80 degrees with a 60-degree return temperature. So that's a 20-degree delta T. Now, that meant changes to the refrigerant cycle. It meant changes to the evaporators, changes to the condensers. So it's almost, you know, redesigning the equipment specific to the needs of the hospital.
So tailor-made almost.
Getting close to that, yeah. I mean, it was based on an existing platform, okay. Something that we had, and we changed the components to ensure that we could deliver what the client needed.
Tested on site before delivery.
Absolutely, yeah. When it comes to that level of kind of design and bespoke nature of that application,
would you offer the same facility? You mentioned modular for education. Would you offer the same support for that kind of setup?
So yeah, the modular equipment that we make comes from Japan, where modular technologies are much more popular. The Japanese culture around manufacturing is about actually not doing things in a bespoke way. It's more about making sure you've got repeatability. You can make, the Japanese are very good at making something very well and then repeating it. That's where Japanese manufacturing really kind of is world leading. So yeah, it's a very different setup. So we don't offer factory witness testing, if you like, because we're confident that if we make 10 or 50 or 100 of a particular product, that they will be exactly the same. The end of line testing and a lot of effort goes into standardizing that mass manufacturing process so that we don't need to go back to the factory to make sure that that particular unit is meeting its particular standard, because we build that into the entire kind of manufacturing process.
We're almost at the end of this podcast, but consultants and specifiers, our listeners, will certainly want to have more information, look at those case studies, look at the products and services. Where can they find out more information?
Yeah, so our website, it's les.mitsubishielectric.co.uk, and also our document library, which is library.mitsubishielectric.co.uk, where there is a huge amount of information where you can learn more about some of the projects that we've worked on, the products that we've talked about, and kind of more wider reading on our hub, more articles on maybe some of the earlier discussions that we had around what's changing in the UK with regards to legislation and drivers.
Richard, thank you very much. Really useful answers. This Let's Talk podcast is part of Mitsubishi Electric's Consultant Focus campaign. We hope you enjoyed it and very much look forward to you joining us again for the next episode.